I try and share research or findings, I want folks to be involved. James, I want the designer to be looking at my survey and helping me design the survey to make sure that we're getting the right feedback.
These are originally live chat sessions that I held, and you can join them in the future every Tuesdays at 5 p.m. PST on sales.n.pixels on Instagram. My name is Koji, and this is Sales and Pixels.
Leif is a UXR director at Udemy. He also holds a PhD in ethnomusicology, anthropology of music and popular culture. He also worked in some other companies, including Google, Uber, and he also was a lecturer at UC Berkeley. Hey, Leif.
Hey, this is working. This is my first time on Instagram Live, so glad everything that we didn't get any tech snafus. Really good to see you, Koji.
Yes, great to see you. Welcome. Welcome to Sales and Pixels.
Thank you. I've really been, I've listened to some of the past episodes and I've really enjoyed the content.
Oh, great. Good to hear. Well, yeah, I just started this, you know, kind of like finding a way to have more lightweight conversations outside of the work environment, like to kind of like replace of the hallway conversations that we usually have at work. But now with even more people, because I can reconnect with people like you. So I'm glad that you accepted the invite. Thank you so much.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. And I just saw Sun joined, and she was one of your awesome past guests too, and we all worked together. So miss you, Sun. Great to hear your voice on Koji's podcast a little while ago.
Yes, you're gonna see a lot of familiar faces here, hopefully. All right, Leif, let's kickstart. So you did, and I remember that we talked about this before at Google, that you did a PhD in ethnomusicology, and I can't necessarily pronounce this word that greatly, but ethnomusicology is anthropology of music and popular culture. How do you end up in UX research, and how you connected that background in ethnomusicology to what you do today?
Yeah. You know, you're not alone. Even native English speakers look at that word and their eyes go wide and they don't know what it is. So it's a little bit of a niche thing, but, you know, it basically described it perfectly. It's basically using the anthropological ways of doing research, but really focusing on music. So not just looking at music as a sound, but looking at music as a cultural practice, as a social practice, the way we use music to form identity, form community, the way we sort of come to know the world about us. You know, there's a lot of things that are embedded in music. And so ethnomusicologists might look at everything from like, you know, sort of how, you know, parents teach their kids values embedded in sort of music to, you know, sort of the ways, you know, a lot of my research focus was on how governments in the Middle East used music as a way to sort of form a sense of national identity. And part of that was looking at how the governments, you know, sort of control different technologies. They control the satellite TV. They control the big, you know, sort of big national broadcasting things. And they put forward almost like a brand of what it means to be from Bahrain or Kuwait or Qatar. And then, but not everyone agrees with that narrative, right? So sometimes you see counter narratives being put forward, and those are oftentimes being used with different technologies. So, you know, cassettes or, you know, blank CDs that they record their music on and kind of spread from person to person. So you can kind of see how different narratives of what it means to be from these countries is spread through different technologies. And I love being a nerdy academic, and I love being in the ivory tower and you know, sort of, you know, all those kind of stereotypes. But I guess at one point in my career, I decided that I really wanted to do something with a little bit more of an applied factor. And so I looked around. I did some work in the public sector. I, you know, did a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and then decided that, you know, hey, maybe working in industry would be cool. And took a little while to sort of find the right on-ramps, but I'm really grateful that I've got to work with a lot of great folks and, you know, sort of learn on the job as well as being able to bring in some of that academic background. And it's been, you know, at first I said, you know, maybe I'll do this for 6 months. And now I think it's been about 8 or 9 years. So wow. I'll let you know when the 6 months are over.
Nice. Cool. I really like what you mentioned about music, because I feel like when I you know, when I thought about inviting you, and I was remembering conversations we had, and also looking at the things that you did after Google, you gravitate around education, around you know, culture, and I think music is part of that. So great to hear that the connection is there with anthropology, of course, and but even with music itself. Yeah. So now you're Udemy, right? And in a very different field that you worked with me, I think back then we were working on social networks, I believe. And I just wonder now, like, I guess there is this connection, but why did you choose Udemy, and why did you choose EduTech to be your next challenge in your career?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's really been fun to sort of explore a whole bunch of things and bring that to the sort of you know, ed tech kind of arena. But I just love the mission, you know, especially at Udemy. We have I think we're now up to over 150,000 courses in 63 languages. We've got millions of learners, and it really is about sort of lowering the barrier and creating access and opportunity. And, it, you know, it sort of ties in a little, like the thing I missed most about leaving academia was the teaching part. So I love that I'm back sort of being involved in teaching, and just sort of the power of lowering the barriers and creating access. I mean, we're so lucky to be working in these Silicon Valley tech companies, and it's normal for us to be side by side with people that went to Stanford or, you know, all these fancy, amazing schools. But like for a lot of folks in the world, that's just not simply something that they can do, either where they're at in life or the country that they're in or the advantages or disadvantages they had leading up to that. So it's been really fun to be at a company that's really working to kind of lower those barriers and create opportunity. And then the other side of that is I don't, you know, I'm not the only person that went to Udemy for that reason. So it's really built like this fun, nerdy, collaborative culture, because a lot of people are there, at least in part because of the mission and sort of what we're doing. And so there's it's a great kind of like like-minded tribe of people that are interested in some of these same kind of issues. So, you know, whether it's folks on the sales team or in corporate communications or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. they're still really invested in this idea of like, how do we, you know, create educational opportunities? So it's really fun to work with everyone there. And I love that part of it.
That's very cool. And I know that empathy is like a big common topic when we talk about research. When you think about empathy in your job today, how do you think empathy can help you to build new products or improve the experience that you guys build at Udemy?
Yeah, empathy is such an interesting word. You know, it's definitely a buzzword, and I think it's been used in so many ways that it's almost lost some of its meaning. Mm-hmm. And I know there's some really smart folks out there like Vivian Castillo who have sort of problematized certain aspects of how we sort of talk about empathy. You know, at times empathy can almost be a little like condescending. Like, oh, we're empathizing with those people. So I think for me, one of the challenges is there's also a lot of great things about empathy, right? If you were thinking about who do you want to have like a romantic relationship with, a lot of times you'd say, I want to be with someone that's empathetic. So there's definitely a good part of empathy, and we just kind of have to watch out. And the other thing I've seen, not really at Udemy, but at some other places, is sometimes empathy can almost be weaponized. You know, like I have an idea for a product and I'll be like, oh, well, I'm the more empathetic person. And so that's why we should do this and those people. So I get a little worried. And I think it's also important that we be empathetic with our you know, stakeholders. So, you know, the engineers, they have these incredibly difficult jobs and tech debt and navigating those things. We need to be empathetic to them. You know, the lawyers that are trying to keep us from doing all those, we need to be empathetic with them. So, you know, thinking about all the different stakeholders, not just the end users, but so I'm sort of not answering and answering at the same time, but, you know, I think we have to balance all those certain parts of empathy and make sure that we're kind of on the right track, I guess you could say. But, you know, when I think about sort of where empathy maybe first got its sort of big moments in user experience and human-centered design, it really is about understanding the lived experiences of the people that we're building products for. And I know, you know, in your career, this is something that's come up a lot too. You know, if you're designing for someone that's learning data science in Egypt, you know, I can't just be like, well, what would I do? You know, I have to really try and understand their life and their challenges and what devices they're using and things like that. you know, we're a two-sided marketplace. So we also have to figure out ways to create new instructors. And in other countries, you know, not everyone is sort of entitled to be an expert. You know, in some cultures, you know, if you have a certain background or you're a certain gender or you're a certain ethnicity, and this is in the United States too, you might not necessarily feel empowered to be someone that can be an expert, but you could still be someone who's a fabulous teacher, you know, on the Udemy platform. And so there's a big challenge there. How do we understand what those barriers are and help those people, empower them to sort of do this thing that they might want to do, but not necessarily feel entitled to do because of all this kind of, you know, cultural, social stuff. So I know that was a little bit of a rambling answer, but it, on our platform, it just intersects us in so many ways, and it's part of the fun.
Right. And it's interesting what you said, because I have a friend who is also who also has anthropology background. She's a researcher in Brazil, and she keeps me telling me similar things about how careful you should be with empathy and how you frame, how you talk about empathy. So it's good to hear that different perspective here. All right. And you you worked, you know, talking a little bit about your work and your past work, you worked for 2 months at the Center of Humanitarian Data in the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. How was that experience for you? Because I think this will be the kickoff for a couple of other things that we're going to discuss after this.
Yeah. I was so grateful. You know, the government bureaucracies, they love the acronyms almost as much as tech. So everything has these long names and stuff like that. But I was so grateful. You know, it was in the Netherlands was where the office was. So first off, I just felt grateful to get out of sort of Silicon Valley Bay Area and sort of interact with the world and look at different problems and different structures. You know, in some ways, the grass is greener on the other side. You know, they don't necessarily have to worry about sort of like a business case in the same way that we might at a Silicon Valley company. But the grass is also not greener in other ways because, you know, there's other fundraising structures and the bureaucracy of these big, you know, intergovernmental things and sort of some of the sensitivities that they have to navigate. But, you know, I guess for me, there was a couple big takeaways. One, it was just so exciting to see human-centered design firsthand being applied in sort of different ways. You know, it's not just sort of the tech companies that are embracing this approach, but it's really great to see it having this transformative power in more and more kinds of organizations. So it was fun to sort of just have a 2 month, you know, visit to kind of see that. And then also, you know, that there are some differences in that kind of more European style of you know, a human-centered design, you know, maybe a little more flavored by service design and some of these other sort of commingled traditions. So it was kind of fun to sort of get a little flavor of that and get the fresh air. And then also, you know, take with the folks, you know, so this platform is basically a warehouse to make data accessible, both to, you know, NGOs, to governments, as well as communities. And so it was just so amazing that, you know, the user interviews I was doing was like, you know, the head of sort of technology infrastructure at the Netherlands Red Cross, and thinking about like just the amazing ways they're using data and all these amazing sophisticated ways and things like that. And then just tons and tons of these other, you know, cool NGOs and things like that. So one thing I love about user research is I also just learn about the cool things that people are doing, you know, whether it's a social product at Google or a learning, you know, platform at Udemy, or these people that are using data for all these different humanitarian challenges. You just kind of learn about the world in new ways. And that's part of, I think, what keeps the work really interesting.
That's awesome. It's great to hear. And it's great to hear your excitement around research and how you approach the research. That's very refreshing. And connecting to that, I visit the Zaatari refugee camp, the largest Syrian refugee camp with around 80,000 residents back in, you know, 3 years ago. I think right now it's probably bigger than that. I was amazed to see how refugees use e-learning platforms, including Udemy, to learn English, technology, you know, sometimes even like, you know, manual work or how to fix something at home or how to, you know, teach their kids to do something specific. And I am curious about your perspective, and you talked a little bit about that, but what's your perspective on how technology can help people in conditions like refugees or people who are displaced in their countries?
Yeah, and it's such a pertinent question because, you know, we see this happening so many times, and by all indications, you know, with climate change and things like this, this is not a problem that's going to go away. Like, we're going to face this, whether it's in South Sudan or, you know, in Sri Lanka or, you know, other parts of the world, in the Rohingya. You know, this is something that we're all, you know, going to be thinking about. And, you know, this ties in a cool way because you're talking about e-learning, you know, ties in a little with my background in this sort of humanitarian. And then, as you know, my family comes from Syria. So the sort of plight of these people in particular is, you know, very near and dear to my heart, something I've thought about and read a lot about that refugee camp. I haven't visited myself, but, you know, would love to hear in a bit about your experiences there and stuff. But, you know, it's something that I'm proud Udemy has done some work on. We've done some things where we've, for like a holiday drive, we contributed course credits to Syrian refugees and other refugees in different places. I know that some of the other edtech platforms have, I think, worked directly with that the camp that you're talking about in North Jordan and with some of the other ones. So there clearly is a need. And, you know, when you look at all the studies about, you know, whether you're college age or K through 12, if you're out of school for a few years, that deficit might stay with you, you know, for sort of the rest of your life if you're not able to catch that up. And there's so many challenges in terms of scale, right? You might have the one amazing teacher, but can you scale that person's impact? You know, a lot of the buzzwords we use in tech, you know, directly translate to the challenges that are being felt in these places, as well as being able to provide sort of more specialized topics, providing folks to sort of do some of the self-paced learning as well. So a lot of times what I'm seeing is it's oftentimes the sort of hybrid approaches that are important, right? You give kids the opportunity to be in that classroom for a few hours, but then you also create opportunities for them to do some self-directed learnings or pursue their passions or, you know, engage in something that they're really excited about. And I love seeing like the intersection of all these things at the same time. And that's where I think it's amazing. But there's so many challenges, right? Because you need the hardware, you need the infrastructure of like the connectivity and electricity. You know, a lot of the refugee camps, the technological and electrical infrastructure just isn't there. And so that can be really hard. And then there's sort of that capacity building. So how do you turn the high school senior into someone that can start teaching the fifth grader? How do you turn the college senior into someone that can teach the high school senior? And sort of being able to perform these kind of loops and feedbacks and things like that. And then just that fundamental challenge of like, again, those of us that have been so lucky to have gone to good educational institutions, we take for granted the ability that we can learn on ourselves. You know, we can sort of teach ourselves things, that sort of autodidact or sort of self-directed learning. But if you haven't had a really robust educational background, it can be really intimidating to just be like, oh, I'm going to teach myself this new topic. And so mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, part of the things we have to do is help figure out, like, how do we teach people how to learn as like kind of a first step? And that's a big challenge, too.
That's interesting. Yeah, I can speak to visit to the refugee camp a little bit. So the Zaatari is large as like a city. And I noticed that they have two internet centers, that's how they call it, or internet cafes internally. And that's where they go to use the computers that have access to the internet. Unfortunately, they don't have 3G or 4G access at all. So the only way to access is going to this internet cafes inside the refugee camp. It's interesting because one of the things that I noticed is that especially women and the girls are like super into technology. They are there in the internet cafes all the time. They use e-learning platforms to learn, especially language. Like English is for them is like, oh, English to me is a way to think of outside my bubble here. So if in some point in my life I decide to create something, a business outside the refugee camp, or if I want to start something, if I understand English, that would be, a great way to, you know, have access to the world outside Jordan in that case. So, yeah, I think the the reason why we were there, we were invited by the Queen Rania, the Queen of Jordan, and we're working with Google.org. I actually wrote an article back then about it, and basically we stayed there not for a very long time. I think in total was about a month, and we had a design sprint where we looked at the challenges that they had, and they had a platform called EdRock, which was used for kids to learn, to continue to learn in the original Syrian curriculum outside Syria, because that was a problem. Like, a lot of people wanted and aspired to go back to Syria. And so for the kids, ideally they should have the same curriculum, because if they come back, they have to have some sort of like compatible curriculum if they come back. So that was the idea, and EdRock was this platform where they could continue to learn, and they could continue to have the K-9 curriculum with the help of the school, with the help of the teachers in the refugee camps, and sometimes their own parents. So it was very exciting. We did some research at the refugee camp, but we also went to public schools, and we talked with students there to understand what the challenges are and how, what type of technology we could use to help them. Yeah, Thaisa just shared a link that was published on Google Design.
I remember reading it, and I think I actually messaged you on LinkedIn right after I read the article. So it's a good article. I encourage folks to click on it and read it.
Thank you. All right. So this is a very, you know, interesting, and to me, something that really interests me is to think about education and how education can really impact on a lot of lives that maybe don't have the access that we have here in the US. So thanks for doing this at Udemy. I really appreciate your work. So we have many challenges in our century. I was reading this book, The 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, I think that's it. And there is a couple of things there. One is refugee crisis, there is climate change, structural racism, economic disparities, all of those challenges that we know very, they're very clear in our faces right now. How do you think researchers can impact positively, or at least bring some light to some of these challenges?
Yeah, there's so many dimensions to this. I mean, I would start off by saying that I've been really excited to see human-centered design generally impacting a lot of those areas that you just mentioned. And also sort of like parallel strains, like in healthcare, you know, they talk about patient-centered design, and it's maybe drawing on some of the very early similar thing that had kind of diverged, and now they're kind of cross-pollinating. Or a friend of mine is in the hospitality industry, and there's a whole kind of thing there called the art of hosting. And it kind of approaches, you know, for that whole industry, like, but it's, again, some of the same very fundamental principles about, you know, how to take feedback and iterate and, you know, design for different perspectives and create experiences and kind of think expansively. And a lot of the sort of pillars of human-centered design. And it's been really fun to see people trying to apply these same principles to climate change or make the legal system work better or sort of things like that. So, you know, it's obviously not one thing is going to solve everything, but I think that we can make a contribution to, I'm sure, all 21 or at least most of the 21 of those things by applying these kind of principles. And of course, from, you know, my bias, you know, research is a big part of that human-centered design kind of process. You know, part of it is thinking about data in new ways. Like, I think a lot of folks like to think of themselves as very data-informed or data-savvy, but, you know, sometimes it gets a little more complicated, and thinking about the nuance of data and the ramifications and how to interpret data in different ways. And so I think one of the big roles of a researcher is to help those around them to think about data in a more sophisticated way. Right now at Udemy, myself, the learning and development team, and the head of data science, we're kind of trying to make an internal learning path to help the whole company get a little more sophisticated in data. And this is a tech company, so these aren't folks that know nothing about data, but we still think that there's headroom. We can all get better at this kind of thing and make sure that we're drawing the right conclusions and knowing when to be skeptical and when to sort of approach things in different ways. And I think a lot of the times when you see people looking at the criminal justice system, it's people cherry picking data to prove their viewpoint. Like, oh, you know, this is what causes crime or this causes crime. And, you know, nothing is that simple. I think that's the other thing you learn from research is like almost everything is because of a lot of things. And it's just a very messy, complex system. And same thing with healthcare, same thing with climate change. And so it's so easy for these sort of newspaper headlines or hot take Twitter, you know, kind of things to be like 62% X, you know, but like, oftentimes looking behind the number is where you really start to get a better understanding. And then of course, being able to layer on that qualitative element as well. It's so easy to talk about these things in these abstract numbers, but if we really want to sort of make that next level of improvement, it's oftentimes by adding a more qualitative or a mixed methods kind of approach to these kind of things too. And I think there's a big, you know, I think sometimes the qualitative side can be a little, I don't know, like we're not as fierce in our advocacy. We almost feel a little insecure compared to sort of like big data. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that there's opportunities for thick data to also sort of put itself out there as a perspective and inform some of these conversations.
Got it. How do you, you know, talking about this numbers that sometimes they might be sliced in a way that is tricky or, you know, can tell any type of story. Like, do you have any tips on how we can, you know, identify when something is not really telling the full story?
Yeah. I think also it's making things interactive. You know, in my career, when I first started in my career in industry, I was at a consultancy. And so I was very much saw myself as sort of the scientist and the expert. And I do the research and everyone sits there and then I give you the data. And, you know, that's my job, you know. And I think as I've evolved in my career, I want to be good with my methods and rigor and everything. But I also think of myself as a collaborator and a builder. You know, I might not be a good designer. I might not be a good coder or whatever, but I'm part of a team that's making something. And so I think that that needs to go both ways. And so when I try and share, you know, research or findings, I want folks to be involved. You know, I want you to be there in those sessions. I want the designer to be looking at my survey and helping me design the survey to make sure that we're getting the right feedback. When I'm presenting the data, I don't even want it to be a presentation. I want it to be a cool conversation and collaboration and talking about the implications and this angle and that angle and a really dynamic thing. The thing that frustrates me the most sometimes earlier in my career is I would present a research finding and then all the exciting conversation would happen in the hallway as people were leaving the conference room. You know, and that almost made me feel like I failed, right? If all the cool stuff is happening as people are leaving sort of this ritualized, you know, report, you know, readout space, you know, that seems to be a misalignment. So how can I create that room, a place where we can sort of talk about things and have the skepticism and think about the second order effects and think about the different sort of dimensions and kind of things like that. So the more you can make it interactive and, you know, I've also sort of tried to apply the principles of human-centered design to my reports. You know, so it's, again, not just about how cool I am or how smart I am or how good of a researcher I am, but how do we make this a really cool thing that everyone is going to get something out of? And I still have a long way to go, but that's definitely the North Star.
The usability of your report is important, I guess.
Exactly. And I'm sure, you know, in your career, you've probably seen the whole spectrum, you know, of very usable reports and less usable reports.
Yes. You know? Wide variety. Okay. So we're getting to a section where I call this rapid fire. And it's a series of questions that you give me a very short answer.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'll do my best.
Okay. Let's do it. First is research can ...
Research can create more questions that you have to research.
Wow, I love that. That was very quick thinking. A moment you will never forget in your life.
A lot of it, sure. I mean, this isn't research related, but I'll never forget going between Beirut and Damascus. They have these shared taxis. And I remember doing it late at night. And so I'm kind of crammed in a backseat with all these strangers I don't know. And it's this super old car. And we kind of went over this. There's a couple mountain passes. And we went over one mountain pass. And all of a sudden, there was no light pollution. and just being there and all the stars and all that you could kind of hear was sort of the engine and the tires and sort of really being in that moment with these strangers, but yet it felt like so intimate. And I don't know, it's just always been one of those moments that kind of really crystallized for me. So not research related, but yeah, just kind of a memory.
It's great. Your hope for 2021?
More boring than 2020.
More boring?
Yeah, 2020 has been too exciting. There's been too much going on. I hope 2021 is very calm.
Got
and,
it.
You know, no surprises.
Likewise. That makes sense now. What is a great day made of?
Great day is made out of definitely good food and good people. I think those are, I mean, it's kind of cheesy, but that's what gives me a lot of happiness. Yeah.
Nice. Something you like to change about yourself?
I wish I was 20 years younger.
Oh, plus one. Always. Great, you done it. Loved it. Yeah, anyways, I love the conversation, but unfortunately we're getting close to the end here.
Okay.
And I want to give you some space to, you know, maybe leave us some words or provide some of, you know, additional feedback or additional words to people who are watching us right now. So this is your space.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I'm trying to think. Yeah, I think that, you know, the one thing I've been talking a lot with my team at Udemy is sort of thinking about comfort zones. And I think organizations have comfort zones, teams have comfort zones, individuals have comfort zones. And we kind of have to disrupt ourselves from time to time. And so sort of been thinking a lot about, like, if you want to start designing different kind of products as a company, you have to do it in a different way, or you're always going to sort of gravitate back towards doing it the same way. And this can, I think, happen with researchers too, where, you know, you're maybe really comfortable doing surveys. And so All things being equal, you sort of always gravitate back towards doing surveys because it's like what you're, you know, the logistics of it and all the, you know, how to do the report and everything like that. But, you know, challenging folks to sort of think about mixing it up. And same with designers, you know, I kind of miss the days of folks doing really bad wireframe, not bad, but like rough wireframes. Like I miss those old balsamic prototypes because it allowed you to sort of not get locked into a solution. And even when doing research on them, it allowed the participants to give different kinds of feedback because it didn't look finished, right? So they would be more free to kind of give different kinds of feedback.
Very good point.
And I feel sometimes that we've gotten everything so streamlined, we kind of like end up doing a lot of things the same way. And so that's one thing I've just been sort of thinking about is what are our comfort zones? And sometimes comfort zones are good, right? We need to have a safe space. We need to feel we have our sort of competencies and our sort of abilities. But there's also times to really push ourselves outside of those. So I guess that would sort of be my, I don't know, if I'm going to have sort of a grand thought, it would be to think about your individual, your functional, and your organizational comfort zones and which one of those are worth sort of challenging at different times.
Awesome. Love that. It's crazy. I think this is always something that I 100% believe that it's so easy to forget. I think the industry is really moving towards like more polished and finished designs all the time. So this is a great reminder. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right, Leif. Thanks for your time. I'm honored to have you here. Great to reconnect with you again and hope to see you soon.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me and appreciate all the folks who are ask some questions and things like that on the live stream. So that was really fun. So thanks. Everyone stay safe.
My name is Koji, and this is Cells and Pixels. Every Tuesdays at 5 p.m. PST on cells.n.pixels on Instagram. Thanks for listening.